So thank you so much for coming to the session. I know it's in the middle of lunch, and we appreciate your coming out to hear about issues that we all get to work with on a daily basis. Me, not so much as the rest of the panel, but advocacy is an issue that the California Endowment cares about a lot. Before we get started, I just wanted to get a sense of the room, just so we know a little bit about the audience that we're speaking to. Is there anyone in the room that works for a funder, like a foundation or the government? Okay, great. So nonprofits? Okay, great. I think you're the majority of our audience of whom we want to make our comments to. And then any attorneys in the room? Okay, great. All right. So what we're going to do is speak a little bit. I'll give a little bit of a perspective of the funder's perspective on what we think about when we decide whether or not to fund advocacy. And then we're going to kind of go down the line. Just a little bit of background for each of us. I think you have all of our bios, but I've been working with the California Endowment for the past 3 years as their in-house attorney. And amongst other things, we do some funding of advocacy, and we also do get in the mix a little bit of trying to bring different nonprofits together to work on advocacy issues. Eric Gorovitz here to my left is with Adler & Colvin, a law firm that specializes in representing nonprofits and funders, private foundations. And Eric comes with a long background in advocacy, direct advocacy himself, working with the West Coast Office of the Alliance for Justice on gun control issues. To my right here is James Harrison. James is with the law firm of Remcho, Johansson, and Purcell, and he's going to help those of you who are with the government to navigate some of the issues that surround what you can do and can't do from that perspective, either for your agency or just even as someone personally working for the government. And James brings years of experience in election law, campaign finance, all those types of issues, especially focused on California. And then Maris Ash is with the Public Health Law and Policy Group, and she's a director of Public Health Law and Policy with a Public Health Institute. And really, I think I'm most excited to hear from Maris, because she has all the war stories. She's actually going to be able to share with you how this really works in the real world. And really share with you kind of the issues that she struggled with going through this, and brings years of experience working on public health issues on the ground and looking at them from the legal perspective. So then real quickly, just to let you know a little bit about the California Endowment, we are a private foundation that was created back when Blue Cross converted from nonprofit to for-profit status, and we are we're created to basically work on health issues for underserved populations in California. And so as you all work with different funders, they may come from a different perspective as far as advocacy is concerned. We actually come from the perspective that we believe it's absolutely necessary, and it is something that we want all of our grantees to work in, and we believe that it's absolutely necessary and essential to achieve meaningful change in health access and health status for Californians. But for us, it's not just about the money. It's really, I think there are two roles that we can play in the advocacy area. As a funder who gets to see things from a kind of a different perspective, we're able to kind of see the, all the players, be it legislative, regulatory, legal activities at the local, state, and federal levels. And we're able to try to bring partners together and use our resources to play a role in facilitating discussion amongst all the players. So we really look at ourselves playing that sort of a role. And then obviously the second part of the role that we can play is we give money. And so we will fund issues that work on advocacy. Eric and James will get into this a little bit more, but there's plenty you can do that is advocacy, but that doesn't quite meet the federal definition of lobbying. So what we're constantly working on are trying to find where those lines are in order to do that. And just real quickly, those kind of functions fall under those activities that don't fall in the under the technical definition of lobbying. And then there are exceptions, nonpartisan research and analysis, examination of broad social issues, technical assistance, self-defense, and jointly funded programs. And there are also some safe harbors that funders can use. So as you talk to your funders and try to work out something with them, you can mention these safe harbors to them. There are general support grants that the funders can give, and also specific project grants that are used where sometimes people refer to them as Macintosh grants, where there's an allocation of the budget to make sure that the full funding isn't used for fully for advocacy. So that's just kind of a general overview of what we're going to talk about, and then I'll just turn it over to Eric next to kind of get into the specifics. All right. One other thing, just if you like, feel free to ask questions through the session. We find that it's probably, if there's a pressing question on your mind, it's better to get it out right away. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm particularly thrilled to be here. My heart is in public health. Before I was practicing as a lawyer, I did a joint degree in law and public health a good while back, and spent most of my career to date doing public health advocacy, mostly in the area of gun control, where I was policy director for large and small organizations, and I did everything from drafting legislation to lobbying to media to the gamut of advocacy activities, grassroots organizing. I did all of it, testifying at city council meetings and at state legislature. I was even booked on Nightline one time, but I got bumped because they found nuclear weapons in North Korea or something stupid like that, and so they didn't have room for me. When the producer called and said, I'm sorry, it was called like 4 o'clock, said, I'm sorry, we're not gonna have you on the program, and I said, that's fine, but you have to call my mother, because I'm not calling her. She's all excited, and I'm not calling her. I'm about to start talking about the tax law. So if you fall asleep in the next 5 minutes, the one thing I want you to remember when you leave is that charities can lobby, and you can lobby a lot, and you can lobby with private foundation money. If you learn nothing else today, and if that's a surprising, clear statement to you, then I consider my work done. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about why that is. But the most important thing to keep in mind is that the law doesn't just tolerate lobbying by charities and charities using private foundation money. It's specifically created to enable that. The tax code was written, I'm not talking about loopholes, I'm talking about conscious decisions that Congress and the IRS made to enable nonprofits to bring their foundation-funded expertise to the policy table. It's there for that purpose. And you shouldn't let anyone tell you otherwise. You often hear a lot of misinformation that you're not allowed to lobby. Board members are often really concerned about getting into trouble with the IRS. And I'm going to tell you, if you follow the rules, you can lobby a ton and not get in trouble with the IRS at all. In fact, they'll see you as exemplary organizations. My personal belief, as someone who comes from a tradition of throwing elbows, is that even service providers should have advocacy as part of your mission. And the reason is, for the same reason that nobody else is serving the population that you serve, nobody else has access to or is telling their stories. And you're in the best position to do that, because you know the people who are on the ground, who are going to the empty shelves at the food bank, or not able to get dental care, or all the many issues that you work on. You know the stories, and the stories are what change policy. It's very easy for the academics, and my role was largely being a bridge between academics and advocates. And it's very easy for academics to sort of talk into the ether, and the policymakers, no matter how good the data is, the policymakers don't do anything until somebody comes in with a compelling story, and all of a sudden the whole dynamic changes. You have the stories. So you need to bring them to the table. There are two different sources of limitations on the ability of a charity, a 501c3. When I say charity, I'm talking about a 501c3 organization that is not a private foundation. There are two different sources of limitation. One is the tax code, which does impose some limits on lobbying. Specifically, there are two, I'm going to come back to these, but there are two different mechanisms for measuring how much lobbying a C3 can do. One is very tolerant, the other is somewhat less so, and I'll talk about them in a little more detail briefly. The other source of limitations is grant agreements with funders, which often contain restrictions, sometimes that have to do with different rules that apply to private foundations. They're subject to stricter rules. And sometimes they just have to do with funders not being fully informed about what can be done with their money. That's one reason why it's great to have the endowment here, because not only are they fully informed, but they're really good advocates about how to other funders about how to make it easier for you to spend their money in the ways that the law allows you to do. So you have to pay attention both to what the law allows and to what your funding agreements allow. So when I talk about lobbying and how you can do it under federal law, you have to have unrestricted funds to be able to do that. Funds where the foundation, the funder, has not said you can't use our money for lobbying. And you can negotiate sometimes that issue with funders. So another little point to take home is keep in mind that might be a conversation you can enter into with some of your funders. So the two tests in the code, the first is in the language of Section 501c3 itself. That's actually a section of the Internal Revenue Code. And one of the things that it says is no substantial part of your overall activities can be lobbying. That's it. No substantial part. But notice it doesn't say no part. No substantial part. So that raises a bunch of questions. What's substantial? What's lobbying? Or even, what's an activity? Helpfully, the IRS has answered none of those questions. So we don't have any information about what counts as lobbying, how much is too much, or what kinds of things count. What we do know is it's not just money you spend. It includes things done by volunteers or things done for free, donated activity, sending something out by email, which doesn't really cost anything. On the other hand, the other thing we know from that, no substantial part of your activities, the other thing we know is that if there's a bill coming up in your field and you want to send a letter saying, we support this bill and you should vote yes, you can do that without looking over your shoulder. You absolutely can do that, no questions asked. If you're going to do more aggressive advocacy, lobbying, for example, you want to sponsor a bill and shepherd it through the legislature, then this question of what counts as substantial starts to get a little nerve-wracking for you. We might be getting in trouble. But fortunately, the code provides a very nice solution. And it's called the 501H expenditure test. Anybody heard of that? Raise your hands if you're familiar with 501H. So a few of you. So that's good words getting out. It's not a new rule, but it's sort of newly discussed in nonprofit circles. 501H says, here's what we mean by substantial. But if you want to use this definition of substantial, you have to tell us you want to do it. So you actually have to take an affirmative step. The no substantial part test applies to any C3. It's part of just being a C3. If you want to use the 501H expenditure test, which I strongly encourage every organization with a budget of less than $17 million to do, there is no downside. But if you want to do it, you have to file a form called Form 5768. It's the world's easiest tax form. It's about a quarter page. You file it one time. It stays in effect forever until your budget gets to $17 million, and then you might want to revoke it, and I'll explain that in a second. But you file this form, and you tell the IRS, we want to use that really good test, not the other one that we don't really understand. Once you do that, you get the benefit of a number of things. You get a precise dollar amount that you can spend on lobbying. And it's based on your budget. Not quite your whole budget. A few things get pulled out. I won't go into that in detail here. But I should tell you, I gave you a, there's a handout that's got much more detail, which is wherever the handouts are. It goes into some more detail than I will go into. It's not physically here. I think it's on the system somewhere. You can download it. Somebody's got it. On the back table, it is physically here. Excellent. So there's a handout with a an outline that goes into greater detail. For small organizations, budget of less than $500,000, you can spend 20% of your budget on lobbying. Pregnant pause there. Do the math real quickly. If you have a budget of $500,000, you can safely, with the IRS's blessing, spend $100,000 every year on lobbying. Is that a surprise to anybody? Does that seem like not what you've been hearing out there in the world? You can spend a tremendous amount of money on lobbying. Most organizations that do lobbying don't get anywhere near that limit. So it's a very permissive limit. As the organization gets bigger, the proportion that you can spend gets smaller. It's not a complicated formula, but it is a formula that I'm not going to go through right now. But it's in sort of incremental steps. And there is $1 million a year cap on any organization, can't spend more than $1 million a year in lobbying. The way the formula works, that happens at $17 million. That's why I use that number. That might, if you're bigger than that, you may be better off under the no substantial part test, because $1.5 million may not be substantial if you have a $40 million budget. Okay, so you get precise dollar limits. Under 501H, only expenditures count. Anything that done that doesn't cost you money doesn't count against your limit. If you have volunteers who go to the legislature and speak on your behalf, but they're not being paid, no limit on how much they can do. If you want to send a lobbying communication to 10,000 people on your list, and you print it up on slick paper and you put fancy postage on it and you send it off in the mail, that's all a lobbying expenditure that counts. That same communication sent to the same people by email, there's no cost. So you've accomplished the same thing, but it hasn't reduced your lobbying limit. It hasn't, you haven't taken a hit on your lobbying limit at all. Yes?
So for the time it takes me to draft the fancy letter via email and to organize all the people who are contacting the legislators, that's direct lobbying?
Paid staff time is lobbying. Whether it's direct or not depends on who you're targeting, and I'm going to come back to that. But that, yes, this paid staff time counts, and prep time counts, and direct expenditures count. If you have to travel somewhere and pay for a plane ticket or pay for a hotel room. I don't want to get too much into the details here. But so the precise dollar amount. There is also a specific definition of what counts as lobbying. And it's broken into two types, direct and grassroots. I'll just tell you briefly the definitions. Direct lobbying is a communication with a legislator that reflects a view about specific legislation. And I can spend 3 hours parsing that definition for you. The outline is helpful, but most of those components mean basically what you think they mean, but not all of them do. A communication with a legislator that reflects a view about specific legislation. That's direct lobbying. You can spend the entire lobbying limit on direct lobbying. There's also a limit on grassroots lobbying. Grassroots lobbying is a communication with the general public that expresses a view about specific legislation and asks the general public to weigh in, to participate in the public in the legislative process. Ballot measures are a special case. In ballot measures, the public is the legislature. So communications about ballot measures are direct lobbying, which is good news because you have more money you can spend. The grassroots lobbying limit is much smaller. It's a quarter of the 25% of the total lobbying limit. So 501H tells you how much you can spend. It tells you exactly what counts as lobbying and what doesn't count as lobbying. So you know those definitions. But there are also in 501H a number of types of communications, which Peter alluded to, that fit the definition of lobbying. They're a communication with a legislator that expresses a view about specific legislation, but nonetheless don't count as a lobbying expenditure because they fall within one of a number of specific exceptions. The most common one for C3s is nonpartisan analysis, study, and research. That's when you do a robust discussion of an issue. I did a bunch of these on issues like ballistic identification technology, for example, when I was doing gun control work. We did a report on two different technologies for identifying the firearm used to discharge a shell casing that's recovered at the scene of a crime. And we looked at the different technologies and where they came from and what works and what doesn't. I flew around the country. I went to conferences with forensic scientists. I went to the companies that make the different technology. I went to firing ranges and fired casings and looked at them under microscopes and did all that stuff, put it all together in a report, nice slick report, big fancy cover on it, nice pictures. And it said, okay, we've looked at all this. Here's where it comes down. Here's what works, and here's what needs to happen. We made very specific policy recommendations, and we sent it off to legislators and others. Communication with the legislator that expresses a view about specific legislation, but it fell within the definition of nonpartisan analysis, study, and research because it was a robust discussion of the issue. A full and fair exposition of the pertinent facts is what the regulations say. So that's a very powerful exception. You can take a position on specific legislation in those reports of yours and not have the whole cost of the report be considered lobbying. Now, there are some pitfalls that you'd want to be checking in with counsel about. That's my little plug for calling a lawyer. Checking in with counsel about before you do this too much, because there are some little circumstances where you can get into trouble. But basically, that's what the code provides. Another one is a written request for technical assistance. If a legislative body, any governmental body, even the governor's office, an agency, writes to you and says, we want your expertise on this issue, come and testify at our hearing, you can respond to that written invitation without it counting as lobbying. Which means, I should say, every time I say it's not lobbying, that means two things. You can do it without limit, and you can spend those restricted private foundation dollars on it. Doesn't fall within the limit. When they say no lobbying, when you get a letter from the endowment that says you can't lobby, of course that's very rare now, right? That says you can't lobby, these are the definitions they use. So if an activity falls within an exception, you can spend their money on it, and that's part of why they're using that language. Was there a question?
So does the fact that it has to be written mean if they call you up and say to testify, you should ask them to send you a letter?
You must ask them to send you a letter before you testify.
Does the email count?
Yes. But it has to come from a body, not an individual member. So it's not enough to get it from the sponsor of the bill and say, gosh, it would be great if you came and testified in support. It has to come from the committee chair on behalf of the committee. Now, I've done a lot of these, both as an advocate and as a lawyer, where you call up and you say, hey, you know, can you do a letter? And sure, they're happy to do it. But it does depend on having those relationships. It's not enough to have just a member say it would be great. It has to be on behalf of the body. It has to be in writing. And because the regulations say testimony or a communication in response to, it has to come first. You can't fix it by getting it after the fact. Okay? One more distinction. Oh, yes, in the back.
That fixing after the fact, even if it reflected an actual communication that occurred ahead of time, the formal request has to be made ahead of time?
Well, that's a matter of you get audited, and what's the IRS going to buy, right? So that I would never counsel anyone to do that. Whether the IRS says you're in big trouble because he sent the letter the day after he called you and asked you, you could do your own math. Another distinction between the two tests is that if you do too much lobbying under the no substantial part test, you're not described in 501c3 anymore, i.e., the IRS can take away your tax exemption. Pretty big stick. If you do too much lobbying under the 501h test, you pay a tax on the excess. Your exemption is not at risk unless you do way too much lobbying over a four-year period. Now, that might all happen in 1 year. If you were really big in 1 year, you get to average over 4 years. But you basically have to sit down one night and say, all right, let's screw with the IRS if you want to lose your tax exemption under 501H. It has to be really overdoing it. So it's 501H is clearer, it's more protective, less stuff counts, you can do a ton of it, and the consequences of overdoing it are much less severe. So it's a very beneficial device to use. Now, I should say, if you have restricted funding from a private foundation, even if you have not made the elected to use 501H yourself, you still get to use the definitions under 501H to determine what you can and can't spend that restricted money on, because that's the definition they're using. So even in that circumstance, you may still be able to take advantage of some of these definitions if you're doing some work that you know isn't lobbying under the 501H definition, even if you're not reporting to the IRS under 501H yourself. Okay? I'm going to talk a little bit about why the private foundations have those restrictions, just for a couple of minutes, and what they actually mean. Private foundations are essentially large pools of money that come from a narrow array of sources, usually a person, a family, a single company. And the concern, the policy rationale for restricting their ability to lobby is they just would have too much influence. It's too much money that too much leverage for one person or company to bring to bear. So the idea was you got to stay out of lobbying. But the code wasn't written to say private foundation funds cannot be used for lobbying. The code was written to say private foundations can't lobby at all. And private foundation, because they can't lobby themselves, they can't buy lobbying from somebody else. They can't give money to somebody else in exchange for lobbying. The way that's phrased in the code is that the money can't be earmarked for lobbying. It doesn't say it can't be used for lobbying. It can't be earmarked for lobbying. And earmarking is defined as an agreement, oral or written, that the money will be used for any specific purpose. So what that means is a private foundation can make a grant to a nonprofit. As long as it's not earmarked for lobbying, the private foundation isn't in trouble. And if the nonprofit spends that money on lobbying and is within its own lobbying limit, nobody's got a problem. A lot of people don't understand that earmarking language, and so often funds are restricted when they don't need to be. There are some real reasons for private foundations to be concerned about how their money is being used and whether their money has been earmarked or not. And that's often what causes foundations to call us for advice when they want to be making grants that free up the grantees. There are two safe harbors, as Peter alluded to, where a private foundation can make a grant, and as long as it's within the safe harbor, even if the money is spent on lobbying, the private foundation is safe. One safe harbor is a general support grant, and that has to be a real general support grant, which means they're not telling you how to spend it. It can't be a general support grant for this program. It's a general support grant, and the funder has no recourse if you spend it all on new linoleum. They can't take it back, because they just said, love your stuff, here's a pile of cash. That's a general support grant. You all know how easy those are to get, right? So there's another option. The other option is the specific project grant. And the specific project grant has to meet certain very specific rules. The nonprofit has to provide a budget that demonstrates how much of the money is going to be spent on lobbying and how much of it is going to be spent on non-lobbying. And if there's a budget like that, and it's a reliable budget, a private foundation can make a grant to the nonprofit to support that specific project without saying you can't lobby with it. And it will not be considered earmarked for lobbying, and therefore the private foundation doesn't get in trouble, as long as the amount of the grant does not exceed the non-lobbying portion of the budget. So I'm going to illustrate this. I'm just going to take 2 seconds to illustrate this and hopefully give you an aha moment, because I love those. Am I okay for time? Okay. $100,000 grant, project. $60,000 non-lobbying, what's left? $40,000 for lobbying. The organization goes to private foundation number one and says, we have this project. Here's the budget. $60,000 of it is non-lobbying. $40,000 of it is lobbying under 501H. And everybody knows that's accurate. We would like you to give us $50,000. So the private foundation can say, okay, that's good. The amount of our grant does not exceed the non-lobbying portion of the grant, which is $60,000. So we can make that grant. We're not going to put a restriction on it. We make a $50,000 grant to this project. We have not earmarked any funds for lobbying. We, the private foundation, are fine. You, the nonprofit, have $50,000, and you can spend it on lobbying if you want. But we didn't earmark it. They actually wouldn't say that last part, but everybody would know it. And the code is designed for that. Now, they go to private, they funded half of their project. They go to private foundation number two. And they say, hey, private foundation number two, we have this $100,000 project, $60,000 of its non-lobbying, $40,000 of its lobbying, and guess what? We're halfway there. We got 50 grand in the bank from private foundation number one. Suppose even private foundation one said, no, you can't spend our money on lobbying. Let's do it that way. So we've got $50,000 in restricted funds, and we've got $50,000 more to go so we can finish the job. Private foundation two, looks at the rules and says, huh, we can make a grant as long as it doesn't exceed the non-lobbying portion of the project. It's not earmarked for lobbying. And they go ahead and make the grant. Now, the question is, are they in trouble? They know the other $50,000 is off the table, can't be spent on lobbying because the first funder said, no, don't spend our money on lobbying. So what you've got is the last 50. Well, the rules provide that each foundation gets to make that determination without regard to other sources of funding. So what that means is you can have your $100,000 project 100% funded by private foundations, and you can spend $60,000 on non-lobbying and $40,000 on lobbying, and nobody has done anything that isn't affirmatively sanctioned in the code. It's an extremely powerful tool. That's what's sometimes referred to as a McIntosh grant, because it originally arose out of a request for guidance from the IRS from the McIntosh Foundation, and the IRS blessed this. It is now embodied in the code. It's now actually in the regulations. It's an incredibly powerful tool. And it allows you to put together private foundation funding that you can spend on lobbying. What is a more common occurrence is you get two $50,000 grants, and they're both restricted. And then you can't spend the 40 grand on lobbying. You still have to go somewhere else and get different money to lobby. That's a big problem. So these rules are incredibly powerful. And you can and should talk to your funders about them and see if you can encourage them along in that direction. Sometimes they need to talk to their own lawyers to make sure it's okay and to figure out how they have to do it. They need some internal controls that can sometimes take a good while to build. And the more complex the foundation is, the more challenging that might be. If they have a lot of grant making going on, they're going to be reluctant to expose themselves to errors, which can expose them to tax liability. So let me just make one more point. James will get into this in greater detail, but most of the time, funding that comes from the government is strictly off limits for lobbying, and that has to do with the funding rules that the government operates under, and there are no ways around that. But you do get to count that money. When you're figuring out how much lobbying you can do, you can count in the denominator. So remember I said a fraction of your budget is your lobbying limit? You get to count money you can't spend on lobbying in the denominator. So you can count restricted foundation funds, you can count government funds, all of which brings that limit up as long as you've confined unrestricted money to do it with. And that might be donor funds, it might be interest earned on invested funds, it might be grant money, it also might be funding from community foundations as opposed to private foundations. Community foundations are subject to the same rules you are. They're C3s just like you, non-private C3s, non-private foundation C3s, and can just give you money to lobby if they want to. So that's a very quick run through what is a really complex area. I am happy to answer specific questions if you have them now or later. Our contact information, I think, is out there. If you don't have any other questions now, I will turn it over to James. Got it?
Eric, real quickly, just to be absolutely clear. So in the scenario you had where you had two funders, funder A and funder one and funder two, and you had said funder one said there's a restriction. You mm-hmm. can't use the money for lobbying. And they're both funding at $50,000. As long as funder two doesn't say you can't use the money for lobbying, you're okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon, I think, to have all the money restricted, which creates a problem. But, and then people start playing games, well, we're not using that money, we're tapping other money. And but yes, the point of that is that each funder gets to compare its own grant to the non-lobbying portion of the budget without regard to what other money is available. And as long as that funder's grant complies with the rule, that funder will not have earmarked funds. So if you see in a grant agreement, these funds are not earmarked for lobbying, that means you can use them. That's the right language. That's the good, empowering, enabling language, as opposed to these funds may not be used for lobbying. You want to see not earmarked. And I actually have had calls from grantees who've said, I don't know, you know, we don't know what to do, we can't lobby, and I asked them to send me the grant agreement, and I can tell them the good news that actually it says it's not earmarked, you can lobby. That's why they put that language in there. Yeah. If you're a small organization, yeah.
And then just now you were talking about a 40-60 split.
I'm saying if you had a specific project that you took for funding to foundations that was $100,000, and you said, we figured out what this project's going to be, and we're going to spend 60% of the money on non-lobbying stuff and 40% on lobbying. That's just the nature of the project.
That's within the whole
exactly. And that's if the foundation is going to fund that specific project, they have to keep their grant below, well, can't exceed the non-lobbying portion of the project they're funding. That's without regard to the rest of your budget. It doesn't matter.
Asking why 40 and not 20, but if the answer is because it's part of your overall budget.
Well, the answer is they're unrelated concepts. It's because that's to do with, oh, I see, yes. It's because it's that project, not your whole budget. Yeah, it's a distinct, so you'd have to have enough room within the budget for that to work, yeah. That's a good point.
They could actually choose within that project, they could have a different split.
You can have, yes, exactly. Within any project, it doesn't matter. You can have a project that's 100% lobby, it's just a lobbying campaign. You can do that. Yes, in the back.
Do you have to be a 501c3
to use the 501h? Only 501c3s need 501h. And some 501c3s can't use it, like churches. Are not allowed, and private foundations are not allowed to use it. But, and churches are excluded because they asked to be. It wasn't an anti-religion thing. It was the churches saying, hello, First Amendment, we'll say what we want when we want, and you give it your best shot. They asked to be left out of the scheme. Yes? Yes. Form 5768, and you send it to the IRS. Keep a copy first because they will have, you know where they put those? You remember Raiders of the Lost Ark? Remember the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark? Right behind where they put the Ark, that's where they keep the 501H form. So nobody's ever going to find it again. So keep a copy of it. And new organizations, actually, when we form new organizations, if there's any possibility they're going to lobby, we file it with the exemption application. And then you can revoke at any time if you want. I should say there is a way to fit, if you're listening to me and going, oh gosh, we lobbied a ton this year, we're in really big trouble, and you're on a calendar fiscal year, it takes effect at the beginning of the fiscal year in which you file it. So if you find that you've done a lot of lobbying or you need to quickly do a lot of lobbying and you hadn't made the election, you can go ahead and file it after the fact as long as it's within the same fiscal year, and it will cover you for that fiscal year. Yeah. Well, it's not operating under the umbrella of the funders. It's just that when the funder says you can't lobby with our money, what they mean is you can't do anything that is defined as lobbying under 501H and doesn't qualify as an exception. So whether you've made the 501H election or not, that restricted funding is restricted only for activities that count as lobbying under 501H. That's what the private foundation means when they say that. They haven't elected under 501H. They're not allowed to because they can't lobby at all. But you get to use that rubric, which is the precise definition. And the advantage of that is it means you can do, you can respond to written requests and tap your private foundation funding source even though it's restricted, because it's not lobbying under the code. Okay? Is that clearer? Yeah. Yeah.
Contact with legislators, just to clarify, also includes any staff that would be affiliated with?
Yes, it includes staff. It includes even people who aren't in the legislature in some circumstances. If you're communicating with an executive branch official with a primary purpose of influencing legislation. So, for example, if you're calling the head of the health department and you want the head of the health department to weigh in on a piece of legislation that's moving, that's lobbying, even though they're not a legislative official. If you're contacting the governor about signing or vetoing legislation, that's lobbying. Filing lawsuits is never lobbying, even if it's challenging the constitutionality of a law or seeking to prevent the placement of a ballot measure on the ballot. The filing the lawsuit is not, that's not lobbying. That's a judicial communication, not a legislative one. Yeah. Well, if you're asking a regulatory body to do anything, it's not lobbying, unless you're asking them to weigh in on legislation. If you're asking them to adopt regulations or allocate funding that they've already received through an appropriations process or grant permits or not grant permits, that's not lobbying, that's not legislative. If you are asking a regulatory agency to participate in the legislative process, then it would be.
Where there's a specific rulemaking process going on?
Rulemaking is not legislative. So if it's within the executive branch, it's not lobbying.
And I would just add to that under the federal definition.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
James will cover the state from the California perspective.
Okay,
but, yes, that's where it gets very complicated. So.
Right. Yeah. That's why you need to hire both of us.
Yeah.
Anything else? Okay, great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. My presentation is geared towards those of you who are government sector employees. So for those of you in the nonprofit sector, I apologize in advance, but after listening to some of the challenges that your colleagues in the government sector face, you may be glad that you are employed by nonprofits. One of those challenges is actually posed simply by the use of the term lobbying, because the term lobbying means different things in different contexts. And the question from the audience just illustrated this very point. Under federal law, contacting an administrative agency regarding rulemaking is not considered lobbying for tax purposes. Under California law, however, lobbying includes administrative action. So in fact, expenditures for lobbying and during a rulemaking proceeding are considered lobbying and are reportable expenditures under California law. Likewise, the definition of the federal anti-lobbying law, which prohibits the use of federal funds for grassroots lobbying, covers any legislation, law, ratification, policy, or appropriation. So one of the things that we have to focus on at the outset is what do we mean when we're talking about lobbying? First, when you become a government employee, you don't leave your First Amendment rights at the door. You continue to have the right to speak out on issues of concern to you, whether they relate to legislation or ballot measures. But you have to be clear that you're doing so in your individual capacity. There are a few caveats to consider here. Unless you've been authorized to speak on behalf of your agency, you should first check to see whether your agency has adopted any policies governing advocacy activities. Many agencies, federal, state, and local, have policies and guidelines for their employees with respect to participation in outside lobbying activities. You should also make clear that you're acting in your private capacity, using a disclaimer indicating that you are appearing in your private capacity and that your views don't necessarily reflect the views of your agency, can spare you a lot of trouble at the end arising from questions about which hat you're wearing. You need to advocate on your own time. If you engage in activities during the workday, you need to make sure that you take vacation time and document it to avoid problems. You also are forbidden from using public resources for advocacy. And although there are many exceptions in state and federal law for de minimis use of resources, it's really best to just draw a bright line and try to avoid any use of public resources. And for the same reason, you shouldn't advocate on the premises of your employer, because even that can raise questions about whether you're using compensated time to do so. These caveats are really particularly important for government employees, because your speech could be attributed to your agency if you're not clear about what capacity you're acting in. And this issue came up several years ago here in California when an employee, a lawyer with the California Department of Health Services, who served in the preventive health section, asked her supervisor for leave to attend a legislative hearing regarding public funding for abortion. It was fairly common knowledge that she disagreed with her own department's views on the subject, and her boss certainly knew that. And for that very reason, he denied her request for leave because he was concerned that her mere presence would create some controversy and that a member of the legislature could ask her to come up and testify. On the day of the legislative hearing, she again asked, "Can I take 2 hours over lunch and attend this hearing? I'll use vacation time." And again, her supervisor said no. Well, needless to say, when she went to the hearing anyway, her supervisor was quite upset at her and actually took action against her, transferred her from the preventive health section to the Medi-Cal section, which wasn't a position that she was interested in. And it ended up resulting in litigation in which she challenged her agency for retaliating against her based on her exercise of First Amendment rights. So these issues can, particularly when they involve matters of controversy, become very serious and have serious repercussions for government employees. Government employees, of course, can advocate for legislation on behalf of their agencies. Generally, local government agencies can lobby state and federal legislators and government agencies in connection with legislation affecting the agency. There's a case here in California called Stanson v. Mott, in which the California Supreme Court made quite clear that lobbying by public agencies is permissible because the legislative process entails or envisions that folks will come forward and speak about the benefits and detriments of legislation, and that certainly includes the agencies that might be charged with actually implementing it. So there is authorization for local agencies here in California, expressly under the government code, to engage in lobbying on behalf of the agency. Before you lobby, however, it is important to make sure your agency is authorized to lobby, and it's also important to determine the permissible scope of the agency's lobbying activities. This too is important because some agencies have broader mandates than others. For example, a taxpayer group here in California sued the University of California over the anti-smoking activities of one of its faculty members, a man named Dr. Stanley Glantz. The taxpayer group claimed that he had engaged not only in traditional lobbying, but also in what we call grassroots lobbying, in which he was engaging citizens in local communities to urge their local city councils, for example, to adopt anti-smoking measures. The court, thankfully, rejected the challenge, largely because in California, the court found that there was explicit statutory authorization for Dr. Glantz and for UC itself to engage in that kind of advocacy. So it's very important to understand what the scope of the activities that your agency can engage in before doing so. In California, we're rather fortunate because the courts have developed a pretty well-defined body of law at this point that define the scope of permissible activities. So under California case law, public agencies can actually conduct research, polls, for example, and they can hire lawyers like me to draft ballot measures. They can even spend public funds to seek out a proponent, which often surprises people. Public agencies can also provide impartial analysis of ballot measures and describe the impact of the measure on the agency. Agencies can also adopt resolutions supporting or opposing ballot measures. So the Board of Supervisors, the City Council, can take a position on a measure. The one clear line that the courts have drawn is that the agency can't then spend funds beyond what it would ordinarily do to advertise the agency's position on the measure. The one clear line here is that agencies can't use public funds to engage in express advocacy, that is, calls to the voters to vote yes or no on a particular measure. This prohibition is embodied in California law and is taken pretty seriously. There was an incident a couple years back in which a member of a county board of supervisors sent an email, one email, to several thousand of her constituents regarding a county ballot measure. The Board of Supervisors had taken a position against the measure. Her email itself didn't contain any express advocacy. It didn't urge her constituents to take a particular position on the measure. But she attached to her email an editorial from the newspaper urging a no vote. Not surprisingly, the proponents of the measure, when they got wind of this, decided to make a political issue of it and filed a complaint with the Attorney General's office. And again, notwithstanding the fact that it was a rather de minimis use of public resources, a single email, a click of a button to send it, the Attorney General's office believed that it raised sufficient concern that it warranted an investigation. So it's an issue that can not only create political problems, but also potentially legal problems. And in California right now, there is a case pending before the California Supreme Court that tests the line. How much can public agencies do in connection with a ballot measure? The case is called City of Salinas versus Vargas. And in this particular circumstance, the city was dealing with a ballot measure that would repeal a utility user's tax. And what the city did was to analyze the impact of the measure and put out both a newsletter and a fact sheet that specified the programs that the city would have to conduct, specified the programs that the city would have to cut if that utility user's tax was repealed, because it would have reduced their budget by about 13%. Anyone looking at the materials the city produced would have probably thought twice about voting in favor of the measure, because it was a parade of horribles. But it was strictly factual in the sense that the city outlined the programs that would have to be cut if it had to contend with this budget shortfall. Once again, the proponents of the measure thought the city had crossed the line and engaged in advocacy, and they sued. The Sixth District Court of Appeal found that the city's activities were permissible because the city didn't urge the voters to vote yes or no. In other words, the court employed the standard that we employ in election law, which is express advocacy. You have to have magic words like vote for or vote against. And that question is now pending before the court. In the meantime, the State Fair Political Practices Commission has proposed a regulation which would adopt the challenger's view. That is, if the city's materials taken in context to the ordinary reader would unambiguously urge a particular result, then guess what? That crosses the line and becomes political activity. So this is a debate that is ongoing here in California, and hopefully the court will hear oral argument this coming year and provide some guidance to public agencies. It's also important to determine the audience for your lobbying efforts. And again, I'm sorry to focus on California, but it's what I know best. We're fortunate that the courts have drawn a fairly clear distinction based on the audience to which the lobbying is directed. In other words, if the activity is directed to the voters in particular, as opposed to the legislature or the courts, it raises more questions. And activities that are directed at the public require a great deal of caution, even if they're educational in nature. We had a situation in 2006 in which a public agency, the California First Five Commission, which is focused on early childhood development, decided to devote a significant portion of its resources to preschool education. And part of that was a public education campaign to convince parents about the importance of preschool education in their child's development. The public education campaign consisted of TV ads and radio ads. At the same time, a ballot measure was in circulation to provide funding for preschool education in California. And there was a two-week overlap while the measure was being circulated for signatures and the ads were still up on the air. As soon as the proponents submitted the measure for signatures, the agency, thinking better of the campaign and wanting to avoid a situation where it appeared to be trying to influence it, pulled the ads off the air. So they were not on the air for literally 8 months before the election. Nonetheless, because the proponent of the ballot measure also happened to be the chair of the state commission, the opponents of that measure claimed, cried foul and filed a complaint with the Attorney General's office. This is a favorite political tactic. And though ultimately the charges were rejected because it was a public education campaign and consistent with the mission of the agency that was engaged in it, it was a very costly distraction for the public agency and all involved. So it's a cautionary note. These same charges, by the way, have been made in the context of the anti-smoking campaign here in California led by the Department of Health Services, which has produced some excellent and very hard-hitting ads. We were involved in a case involving another ballot measure, a cigarette tax, in which the opponents argued that the public agency was misspending public funds because while a measure to repeal the tobacco tax was on the ballot, they were running anti-smoking ads. And the court rejected that again because it's consistent with the mission of the agency. But this is certainly an area where politics can easily mix with the law and create problems that go beyond the legal issues involved. Agencies cannot use public resources to urge the public to lobby legislators on the agency's behalf without some explicit authorization. This issue came up in the context of the California Commission on the Status of Women, which was spending funds to urge the public to contact their legislators to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And the court said it didn't have specific authorization, that it couldn't simply try to get the public to contact the legislature to get the work done. Likewise, the federal anti-lobbying law also prohibits federal employees from engaging in substantial grassroots lobbying campaigns expressly urging individuals to contact government officials. Court challenges, however, are permissible, again, because the audience, excuse me, is not the voters, it's the court. So that has been deemed permissible, and public agencies can use public funds to, for example, file a pre-election challenge to a ballot measure. A couple last caveats. Make sure that you state your agency's views, not your own personal views, if you were speaking on your agency's behalf. And last but not least, it goes without saying, but testify truthfully when you make an appearance before a legislative body, because you could have personal liability. Here in California, we had a circumstance in which the legislature was conducting an inquiry of a technology contract and called a member of Governor Davis's administration before it, and she testified, and members of the committee felt that she had been misleading about a meeting that allegedly occurred, again referred it to the Attorney General's office, who pursued charges against her and actually indicted her. Fortunately, it was dropped, but these things do happen. Just this past summer, some of you may recall Senator Barbara Boxer urged a perjury investigation of the administrator of the EPA based on his testimony regarding California's request for a waiver from the ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So it's very important to not only be clear about who you represent and what your views are, your agency's views are, but also to stick to the facts. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions. No, California law has an express prohibition against engaging in any political activities while in uniform. So oftentimes, for example, you'll see television ads, political commercials with a candidate surrounded by a group of firefighters. You'll notice that oftentimes, rather than wearing their uniforms, you'll see them wearing t-shirts, which might have an emblem, but they're not the official uniforms. They're provided by the campaigns. Yes, Superintendent Jack O'Connell. Though the office looks like it's in a state building, in fact, it was not. It was a set. He used his own free time to do that and didn't use any state resources, abiding by the guidelines we talked about today. That's right. He can use his title. Yes. Well, there are special rules regarding reporting payments to organizations such as associations that engage in lobbying activities with dues from public agencies. So there are reporting requirements, and it's under California law covered, but not impermissible. Yes. Well, it depends what your state contract says, first of all. But if your state contract contemplates that you're going to be engaging in an educational campaign, including reaching out to members of the legislature, then that would be permissible.
Can I, just one more thing. Under, this comes up in the federal lobbying rules as well, the question of whether that communication is a lobbying communication or not. And it could be.
My name is Maris Ash. I'm with Public Health Law and Policy. I'm going to start with a disclaimer. I'm not an expert. I am a lawyer, but I'm not an expert in lobbying rules and laws. What I'm going to do is talk about how we've used these, but if you've got really technical questions about even the examples that I give, I might defer to Eric or to James to chime in. But I've worked both. Before being a lawyer, I had a long career in public health before going to law school, and then since, both in government agencies and in nonprofit organizations. So I want to touch on a couple of different ideas. I'm going to use some case studies and start with what can government employees do, and then what can we do in the nonprofit world, and give some examples, real life examples of what we did, some of which I think you've all anticipated in many ways, but just to give some life to them. So I'm going to talk about smoke-free workplace legislation, tobacco tax increase, menu labeling, and climate change issues, some from when I was a young woman and some from very current time. So what can government employees do? I work here in California, and I worked for a county here called Contra Costa County, and we were the first county in the country to pass a countywide smoke-free workplace legislation. So we had 17 cities and the Board of Supervisors, the county itself. In California, our health departments are mostly based at the county level, not at the city level. So it was a terrible ordinance. You could smoke in your private offices, and so, you know, all the bosses got to smoke, and they'd open their doors, and everybody else would get exposed to it, or vice versa. They didn't smoke, but the people who were out in the bullpen area wanted to smoke. Shared ventilation, all the problems that we have in smoke-free workplace legislation, but a smoke-free workplace being a bar, too. This came later. But we were the first ones to do it. There was no precedent for this anywhere. We had a very activist health department, and it came down to what was good for the public's health. So the Board of Supervisors, we actually had a health educator as the chair of the Board of Supervisors at the time, which was very handy because she understood immediately what the health department was doing was engaging in community organizing. We hooked up with American Cancer Heart and Lung, so we had our voluntary associations in a coalition with the county government working together. And we went to the Board of Supervisors and did a dog and pony show. And they said yes immediately and sent us very specifically on a city by city by city campaign to get the cities on board. And so I, as a member of the health department, could not only talk about the dangers of secondhand smoke, but talk about what the Board of Supervisors did. And that ended up in either two outcomes, the cities saying, all right, we're going along with the board because we won't be upstaged, or we're going to do better than the Board of Supervisors because of the competition between cities and counties so much anyhow, at least in California, I'm assuming that's true elsewhere. And so as a member of a government agency, I represented the Board of Supervisors to 17 cities and urged them to join the county and explain both from a public health perspective and then from the Board of Supervisors' political perspective of why they did this. And it was completely successful. Contra Costa did it. It's city across right next door, Alameda County, wasn't going to be outdone by Contra Costa, San Francisco across the bay from Alameda. Each time, every county did better than the last, so that the fallacies in our own organizing campaign, our own ordinance, which is by far the very best we could do, it was a radical idea to have smoke-free workplaces. This is 1984, radical idea, became stronger and stronger and stronger. San Francisco does something, you know, Los Angeles is going to do it too, and San Diego and Santa Clara County, all the big counties. And by and large, we soon got a critical mass for a statewide smoke-free workplace, and it was in the labor code. It wasn't in the health and safety code, but it was to keep workers healthy. And there were all sorts of exceptions in the first labor code, particularly for bars and restaurants. And those were 50% smoke-free, and bars were had all smoking. But there was so much groundswell, and then the science started developing about exposure, particularly for bar workers to secondhand smoke and testing of urine levels and carcinogens in the urine and all the rest, that it became crazy to have a labor code that wasn't really protecting employees. So from a very modest beginning with not the strongest, you know, in retrospect, not the strongest smoke-free workplace legislation by a long shot, we had this incremental change that now every worker in California has the right to a smoke-free workplace. Even now, people who work outdoors have the right to smoke-free workplaces, particularly in restaurants. That's beginning to come, again, city by city. Oops, let's see. Another campaign, much more controversial, is tax increases. And again, this comes out of the tobacco control world. In California, way back when, we had the highest cigarette tax in the country. You can see that's no longer true. We're at 87 cents in New York City. I think, I'm not sure how up to date this is, but it's pretty close to up to date. It's almost $3 a pack of tobacco taxes. We had a campaign on the ballot, a ballot measure. We have citizens can vote on initiatives in this state to raise the cigarette tax in California by, I think it was $1.50 or $2 a pack. It was a big a big jump that would have put us right up near the top. The governor, Schwarzenegger, is an anti-tax governor, like most governors are, and came out publicly, did not support the ballot measure. Many members of boards of supervisors for the same anti-tax reason did not support the ballot measures. And so this put health department employees in kind of a difficult bind because they were asked, why should we do this? Well, the good news in all of this is that even if you don't have the political cover, the support of the board of supervisors, the city council, the governor, whoever your direct bosses are, you nonetheless can talk about public health. So if the Board of Supervisors is undecided or opposed to tobacco taxes, very common, then the health department can nonetheless provide specific data. And think about the possibilities. Having the science at your fingertips is an incredible bully pulpit. Impact of taxes on smoking rates. We know that the number one cessation measure is tobacco tax increases. That works better than absolutely anything, for particularly for youth, but even for adults. It's the most effective tobacco control measure. What's the likely epidemiological effect on communities? If we know that every 10-cent rise in tobacco tax is a 4% drop in smoking by youth, we can do the math relatively easily and see what we can expect in epidemiological outcomes, and the health department can talk about those facts. We could show a map like I just showed about the tobacco rates, factual information around the country, and in fact, California is way low now, and we still think of ourselves as being so progressive in tobacco, and in many ways we are, but certainly not through our tax structure. And we could do key informant interviews on the data. I want to talk about the dance of politics here a little bit. It is important, if you do not have the support of the legislative body or the elected officials who you report to, that you separate the science from politics. This is the area that government employees in particular get extremely nervous, and in fact, their jobs could be at stake. They feel censored, that they're not allowed to speak about something. It's a very common sense, and there is a dance here that I think has to occur, and the fact that we have both nonprofit organizations and public agencies in the room, it's the dance between those two, and how can we work together from different perspectives to get the government agencies some political cover so they can speak the truth about public health. So the government agency could never say, the health officer could never say, and therefore you should vote for this tobacco tax. You know, I was struck the other night watching the presidential debates where, I forget who it was, asked both candidates, do you think their vice presidential partner would make a good president of the United States? And Barack Obama said, you know, I'm going to let the voters decide that. You know, just, I'm not going to go there. And I think that that's the same message that a health officer would have to give, is the voters can decide. I'm just giving you the facts as I know from a scientific point of view. But wouldn't it be wonderful if American Cancer, Heart, and Lung could get to the Board of Supervisors and say, we need the epidemiological data. You put the pressure on the Board of Supervisors to call in the health department to testify here. And know that there's going to be media in that board meeting covering the evidence that the health department would give. So there is a dance from different sides of the aisles and how we can partner inside and outside of government to give government agencies who have tremendous bully pulpit the cover they need to be able to talk about the science of public health without threat to their job or threat to the budgets of their agency. Very real concerns that they have, and often end up in having the government being afraid of its own shadow when it comes to talking about really critical public health issues like tobacco control or anything else. So that's what I wanted to talk about, what government agencies can do. Sometimes you've got as much authority as given by your elected officials to go forth and talk about public health in an unabashed way and urge others to follow suit. And other times, government employees really do not. And that's where the partnership or the dance needs to happen for public health information to get out there. I think so often it's not part of the political debate because of the silence of agency staff, and that's unfortunate and unnecessary. What can nonprofit employees do? And I want to talk about menu labeling and climate change here. This is from Subway Sandwiches, New York City. You can, if you go on to Center for Science in the Public Interest, or the California Public Health, California Center for Public Health Advocacy, you'll find a whole bunch of these menus. So as people know, New York City's done this. California has menu labeling now. That started with San Francisco and a couple of other counties. Kings County, Washington, a county in Oregon. I think this is a wave, definitely, of the future. We're going to see menu labeling. I'm on the board of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, and they did direct, no-holds-bar lobbying on this menu labeling piece of legislation that was just signed by the governor a few weeks ago. And they did this because they had core and general support from foundations to engage in lobbying. They had donations from private individuals, which were unrestricted funds, and we heard about the 501H, right, test, which they had elected that test, so they had all sorts of money that they could use for direct lobbying. And they have paid lobbyists on their staff that are registered with the Fair Political Practices Commission, and they walk the aisles, and they twist the arms, and they go to committee hearings, and they testify as much as they want and are able to do, and they report it as they need to both the federal government and to the state agencies. So they also engaged in issue softening. They developed a video of people walking into fast food restaurants being given, what the restaurant association wanted is to be able to give brochures to the public. And so they have these brochures which are about that big with, you know, teeny tiny print, not only with calories, but with salts and fats and, you know, whatever in it. And so the video is of members of the public, you know, just Jane Q. Public going in and trying to figure out, well, if you wanted to get the healthiest food, what would you do? And so there's person after person going, and flipping it over and turning it around. And it became viral marketing. It went on to YouTube. And right at the exact time that the legislature was passing, it was voting on this amendment. And it got a lot of buzz in communities because it became absurd that the restaurant industry's position was completely absurd. And it was clear that nobody could understand what that meant and wouldn't be able to make an informed decision at the point of purchase. And the only way, they had patrons saying, well, you know, why don't they just put it up there where I'm going to look anyhow, you know, on the menu board. So it was a very effective non-lobbying way to influence policy, which makes me think about the state tobacco control program here in California. We have one of the major big pushes in tobacco control in the state is to get smoke-free housing. The apartment buildings and condominiums, particularly places where children and seniors live, both of whom have children for asthma and developing lungs, and seniors who might already have lung disease or heart disease, not wanting to be exposed to secondhand smoke. So it's a major policy push that the state health department makes every county write it into their scope of work, all their nonprofit organizations that work with them. My team of attorneys are drafting model legislation for this all the time. What runs on the TV ads, just in general public, without regard to where legislation may be being introduced at any given time, is ads about smoke going through ventilation systems and coming out of electric plugs and doors opening and closing, and how the smoke actually can so easily travel through a building and expose vulnerable residents to the carcinogens and other hazards in the smoke. So always using the media to soften the electorate, like, oh, geez, that's awful. Oh, you know, those poor people. So that when a piece of legislation is being introduced, people are ready to hear it. It's not, wait a second, You can't invade the privacy of somebody's home with telling me what I can and cannot do, which is a typical reaction, but trying to soften the blow of that by making it seem so reasonable that people would be protected from secondhand smoke. And nonprofit organizations do that all the time, too, and can do it freely without that being lobbying. What they need to do is abide by the limits that we talked about, how many dollars they spend, and do the correct reporting, both to the IRS and to the state. Here in California, and I think it's pretty typical, not just for states, but from cities too, particularly large cities, that you've got to report. Here in California, the Fair Political Practices Commission allows as much lobbying as you want to do. There's no limits like the IRS has, but you have to report it. The IRS is different. So, and the foundations control IRS reporting. They prohibit IRS reporting, but not generally FPPC lobbying, Fair Political Practices. So, for example, I want to talk about a campaign that we've just recently been engaged with, which is here in California. We have state agencies working on climate change. Our Air Resources Board, in particular, has been charged with coming up with a scoping plan and will be going into rulemaking starting in January on controlling greenhouse gas emissions. It's a major, major effort. Amazingly, the governor put together a 12 state agencies into a climate action team to work on this. The health department, the state health department, was not one of those agencies. Like, hello, how could this be? So there's been a big push from the public health community to get public health issues integrated into the climate action plan. We are working with a state agency, and at this point, just in a scoping document, not even rulemaking, completely unrestricted. We can do as much as we need to do to influence that agency. We could build the political will for stronger regs. We've got to have regulations that are very aggressive for climate change, and the public health message with the morbidity and mortality is the strongest message that the agencies have. The Air Resources Board did a pretty good job about the lung diseases and the heat-related deaths that would occur, but didn't talk about any of the other public health issues, vector control issues, dislocation of the agricultural industry, any of the co-benefits. If you cut down on greenhouse gases through regulating transportation, not only are you doing the climate change work, but you're also reducing obesity because people will walk more or bike more, and you put in walkable, bikeable communities, and you have these co-benefits that cross into other public health concerns, and that message is such a strong political message that's not incorporated. It had to be. This kind of work can go on very freely from nonprofit organizations. You can't give gifts. You're restricted in giving gifts. I think it's $10. You have to report that, which seems completely appropriate. And you can't make contingency payments to lobbyists. If you win on this, then you know we'll pay you more or something like that. That's, I think both of those are unusual from a public health nonprofit perspective anyhow. That gift giving might generally doesn't come from public health agencies. So we did email campaigns. It turned out that a third of the comments going into the Air Resources Boards were from public health organizations and agencies. It was a very powerful message to them that they had to engage in a broader public health analysis, and so we're very hopeful for the future. And I want to end by saying that non-lobbying is very powerful, both in the nonpartisan analysis and the legislative testimony that Eric talked about, but also in media advocacy and political satire. I mean, what has been more powerful than Tina Fey in talking about some of the top political issues confronting us and our choices for president and vice president of the United States? It's been enormously powerful and completely non-lobbying. So I just want to encourage you to use your sense of humor, just like with the video campaigns about menu labeling or Saturday Night Live or wherever it needs to be. So with that, I'll end. And I'm sure many of you have similar war stories that might have technical questions associated with them that you'd like to pose to Eric or to James about, well, you know, if I wanted to do this and how would I do it and what kind of authority do I have? Jump in. Yeah.
You mentioned that YouTube, now that there's Google Media and so on, what if somebody just wants to post something on their own because there's no regulation there? What's going on with that now?
Well, if a private individual wants to put something up on YouTube?
Well, it might be to advocate directly for something.
Sure. Well, First Amendment.
But if it was produced by somebody else, with money contributions,
so if it was produced by a government agency or if it was produced by foundation funding? Well, you're allowed to spend your money. Spending money is an expression of your First Amendment rights. There's lots of case law on that. And so spending money to influence the election is completely legal. There's campaign finance guidelines in that. But if you're an individual wanting to develop a video to and put it up on YouTube, you can do that. Well, if it's theft, I mean, it could be theft. Somebody else's intellectual property. So that would be a different round of case law.
All those things are online. NBC didn't put them on there. I mean, they put it on their own website. But they didn't put it on there.
Yeah.
I think maybe what you're asking about is circumstances under which that activity being on YouTube gets attributed to the nonprofit. And there are some rules about that. Individuals who are associated with nonprofits have to be a little careful about which hat you're wearing, and you have to be very clear that candidate stuff is a whole different ballgame. We didn't talk about partisan political activity, but that is a third rail for C3. You cannot do it. So a C3 couldn't do this with Palin, for example. You couldn't have Tina Fey and basically take a position on candidates. But you could use a device like that around an issue. But if an individual who's connected with a C3 is doing something out in public, they want to take steps to make sure that they're distancing, that they're being clear that it's them in their personal capacity. It's similar to the government employees in their personal capacity. What you're trying to avoid is the attribution of individual activity to the nonprofit. And in a case where you put something out as a C3 puts something out as a public education piece and it's available to anybody, and somebody picks it up and puts it on YouTube, well, that's not likely to come back to a nonprofit because they can demonstrate it wasn't us. I mean, there's a trail there. And you can demonstrate this was to anybody who can capture this, and somebody else put it up there, it's got nothing to do with us.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think there's room for subterfuge in there that
we'll try to talk about. There may be room for subterfuge, but it won't get you in trouble with the IRS.
Yeah.
Can be, and this actually bumps up against the same rules, the same attribution question. Working in coalitions, which is essentially what you're talking about there, where you have a group that gets together, maybe in the form of an association, it may be something much less formal. It may just be a collaborative enterprise. I was involved in one around gun control where not only was it not formal, but we didn't acknowledge its existence at all. It was, I mean, we would lie to people about it. No, we're not talking about it. But we were. But the maybe I said too much. when you're structuring a coalition and there are people with different kinds of limits, for example, if you have a C3 and a C4, who are part of the coalition.
What's a C4?
A C4, a 501c4 organization is a social welfare organization. A lot of groups that you're familiar with have both a C3 and a C4. If you write a check to a C4, you don't get a tax deduction.
Sierra Club is a good
Sierra
example.
Sierra Club is a C4. They have a foundation. You can donate to the foundation and get a deduction, or you can donate to the Sierra Club. You don't get a deduction. C4s are not subject to the lobbying limits, and they can do some partisan political activity. So they can do stuff that the C3s can't do. If they're working together in a coalition, you have to be careful about whose money is being spent. And the IRS takes a sort of worst-case scenario approach there. So you want to actually document those relationships. And C3s that are contributing, say, to a coalition where the group activity is going to involve things the C3 doesn't want to do or doesn't want to have attributed to it, needs to restrict its funding with an agreement that says you cannot use our money for these purposes. Membership organization, when there are members involved, that's a whole other I'm happy to talk with you about that, but we should do that separately if a whole bunch of stuff comes into play.
What part of when a board of directors of a nonprofit is asked to like endorse legislation or things like that, what piece of that, I mean, is do you have to quantify that in some way, or does it really, how does that fit in the...
Well, if you're talking about legislation under 501H, you're looking at expenditure. Right? So
if there was no expenditure,
there's nothing to report.
So it might be maybe the executive director's time in the board meeting when
there,
they ask them to.
You would, right, if there may be some paid staff time, there may be some portion of meeting. If you know, that can happen a whole bunch of ways. You could have a meeting where what happens in the meeting is the purpose of the meeting is for people to come and make a pitch, and it's all about what position is the organization going to take, and the board of directors is going to make that decision. Well, then you might have food expense, you might have some renting a room, you might have maybe directors are reimbursed for travel to come to the meeting, where the whole event is about taking a position on legislation. You might have some expenditures. Or you could have a scenario where you have a four-hour meeting and you spend 10 minutes on an agenda item. And in that case, you can allocate the expenses to lobbying and non-lobbying. In some cases, there just aren't any real expenses to measure. And that's one of the advantages of 501H. It simply isn't noteworthy if you don't have any expenditure.
But if it's like, for example, say then a whole day, like we have a whole day, it's a policy forum, but it's for other organizations to come and present all their, the expenses for that.
Well,
that we put on, because even though they're...
It's going to depend on the details, and I can't sort of give you legal advice about a specific thing without knowing a lot more about the details. But in general, if you have a mixed purpose event, you can allocate the expenses between lobbying and non-lobbying. Whether the whole thing counts as lobbying or not depends a great deal on what is said there, what's the purpose, how it works, what the activities are. So you really have to look at the specific facts and circumstances.
Okay, I think we're going to end the session officially for now. But if you have any further questions, Maris, Eric, and myself will be here. James has to catch a flight. But please come up and feel free to ask.